Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's like my favorite time of the year that's non-football related, because we can still talk football with the draft a few weeks away. But for us wrestling fans out there, we are less than 72 hours away from WrestleMania. So we're going to get into all that in a little bit. I wanted to focus wrestling heavily. I wanted to go into NFC East talk first. But before any of that could happen, Brandon Bean said, hey, we're going to trade Stephon Diggs because Griff's recording with the trust fund benefactor Jared Silverclite. And there's so much of my mind that was racing about this trade for two reasons. The first being that, hey, he's out of the division. It's great. Buffalo's weaker at receiver. But the big picture question to all this, in my opinion, is it shows how hard it is to win in this league when you think you have everything, and when the results don't go your way. Now I know we can say with Buffalo, they had to play Kansas City. They had an overtime rules change. They missed a wide right field goal. They had the Hamlin thing happen to them, which I'm not saying plays in any of this, but you know what I mean. Like, they've had so many series of unfortunate events to where it all ties back to that. Winning in this league is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, no, it's pretty crazy. I mean, the Bills, it was interesting with them, toward the second half of this season. It seemed like with the change in offensive coordinator, despite having a more stacked receiving room than they've had, you know, with the addition of Dalton Kincaid, it just seemed very odd, week to week, that where they were winning all those games where they were basically just letting James Cook take complete control. It was one of those things where I was just kind of saying to myself, okay, you know, yes, running the ball is often forgotten about in this league, the importance of doing so effectively. But I'm watching this team week to week. I'm like, this is not sustainable. By the time they get to the playoffs, the fact that they're not establishing that consistent firepower, getting this offense to be as explosive as we know it can be with Diggs, where you saw week in, week out, Stephon Diggs just mediocre production, not getting the downfield targets. And you couldn't help but look at him and think, like, there's no way he's totally happy here. There's no way that the relationship between him and McDermott and Allen is as strong as it was, you know, in years past. And now they wind up making this move where they only get a second rounder in return and they're eating most of the money. So make no mistake about this. This is not an acquisition by the Texans. This is a dump by the Bills. And I think it speaks volumes about the disintegration of the relationship between Diggs and the Bills organization. So, I mean, their loss is Houston's game, absolutely. And, you know, we'll get to that in a moment. Obviously, this completely beefs up the Texans' offense. But to me, this is more of an indictment on the Bills' offensive system right now. And then you look at this team as a whole, both sides of the ball, the amount of people that they have now lost in this offseason, you know, it's not enough to the point where you're going to write this team off completely, but their status as an AFC powerhouse has now big time.
I know it's April 3rd, and I don't like to do this yet, considering we don't know who's playing who when. And for all folks out there, it's like, we know the opponents know. But when you play a team, truly does matter, because a team can be different from October to Christmas time. It's the way the season goes, it can change. My biggest thing with Buffalo is I'm not going to call them a Super Bowl contender. I'm also not ready to say, because I've seen Bills fans going, oh, we're not making the playoffs. I'm like, guys, they're still more than likely they're going to win the division, because there's still so many question marks with Miami. I'm going to exploit the DM right now. Danny messaged me today saying playing a home playoff game and coming. And I was like, slow your roll, partner. We're still got a long way to go before that happens for the Jets. And then obviously the Patriots, we all know what's going on there. I have a lot to say about that in a sec. So obviously my podcast has been very Patriot heavy as of late because of the documentary. But with Buffalo, this is the big thing with this trade, is the fact they didn't even wait for the June 1st designation. They just were the Russell Wilson. Yeah, nope, get him the hell out of the building, you know. We'll eat the money. $31 million in dead cap coming next year for Buffalo. I'm going to say this right now. I think their Super Bowl window's closed in the sense of contendership. I don't want to completely write them off and say, yeah, you know, worst of, like first to worst, they're going to finish with like 7-10, 6-11. No, I still think they'll hover around 10-11 wins next year. I don't think they're going to be though that team that you look at anymore and go, oh, hey, look, the Bills are coming to town, or, oh, we got to go up to Orchard Park and play them. It's still going to be a rowdy environment because that's how the Mafia gets down. But when it comes to the full scope of these big-name teams coming in, they're no longer going to be this perennial powerhouse that you look at and go, hey, here they are. They have to earn that trust back, you know? They have to earn the trust of the fans, but more importantly, the NFL community as a whole. And I still say all this because why – for all the flack that they take, Josh Allen is still a top five quarterback in this league. It's not like, oh, he's going out anywhere. And for everyone, I've seen people tweeting about this too, where it's like, oh, they can go get T. Higgins. They can go get Brandon Ayuk. Guys, the power play move for the Buffalo Bills would to be to trade up into the first round, to go get Neighbors, to go get Odunze. I know you do not like hearing that right now. We'll talk about your boys in a little bit. But you know what I mean? That's the move. Or if they want to stay comfortably in the 10s, even get up to the teens in the 20s, they notice a receiver starting to drop that they really like. Like a Brian Thomas, like an Xavier Leggett, or even Xavier Worthy, the star of the combine, ran the 4.22. They can go do that. I'm not ready to hit the panic button on the Bills just yet, but I am ready to come out and say Super Bowl, I don't see them in New Orleans next year on February 9th.
Yeah, I think that that's a fair take. They've just kind of, I think they've regressed from, yeah, elite, top of the line contender, premium team to good, you know, better half of the AFC going to be in the playoff hunt.
The Andrew Luck Colts era.
Right. Not a feared team. Just a solid team. And with Aaron Rodgers back healthy for the Jets and the Dolphins having the firepower that they possess, the AFC East is 100% up for grabs. It is, and it already was last year. It came down to the last game of the season between the Bills and the Dolphins, right? And that was without Aaron Rodgers, a full season with the Jets, and, you know, of course, them upgrading in other areas, you know, retooling. So I think it's going to be a very, you know, very competitive division there with no clear-cut favorite. I'm not ready to name any of those teams as a division favorite right now, like 100% not.
This is the part of the podcast where I feel like people are going to say, Griff, you're forgetting someone. No. I'll talk about them in a bit. But I've had people already say this team's not going to be competitive next year. And I'm saying yes to that because I want Patriots fans to get the understanding of, hey, they might win some games that you don't expect them to win, but they're not in that position yet. Because
you guys are in a resetting position. You know, a quarterback change. You know, a roster that's got a lot of areas that needs to be addressed, especially basically the entire offensive side of the ball. I mean, we're basically in the same spot. So, I mean, this is just going to happen. It's not going to be an overnight thing. I mean, it's all going to depend on, you know, how does the draft go? How does camp go? Because there's one thing the NFL has shown us year in, year out, it's not as simple as looking at, oh, this team on paper appears to have the least talented roster, therefore they're going to win the least amount of games. It never pans out that way. You never know how the pieces are going to coalesce or how things are going to, you know, how teams can be surprisingly competitive, you know, when game day arrives. So it's one thing where you're not really going to know until the season starts how well everyone's gelling. But, yeah, I mean, on paper, you would not expect them to be a contender necessarily.
No, and this is why I have a love-hate relationship with the Houston Texans. Like, I was kind of supported them this year because I became a C.J. Stroud fan. Shout out to the Stroud boys. Obviously, look, I'm not getting political here, but they basically took the Proud Boys and basically put Stroud in front of it, and that's the fan group is called. But I like it, I hate it, because I feel like everyone thinks now it's like, hey, go get your C.J. Stroud and rocket ship to the moon. You know, that's where I don't like it, because I feel like everyone sees teams like what Houston did, and all of a sudden now it's, hey, Houston's this, Houston's that. But what if – and Houston, too, a team who had to come down to the last game of the year to win their division, they also have a pretty tough schedule. They play the NFC North. They play the Dallas Cowboys, who I have a lot to say about them in a bit. But they also play the AFC East. They're going to get a first-place schedule this year. So I think there's going to be a couple games that Houston loses to where everyone's going to go, oh, are we so sure of the Texans? Like, you know, last year, too, the Jets got that, like, royal primetime treatment going into the year based off what people are thinking they're going to do. Hell, the Houston Texans are going to get that exact same thing this year. They had one primetime game last year. They're probably going to get 4-5 this year. So from a Houston Texan perspective, Like, and just tying it in everything. Like, that's where, you know, it's like, oh, hey, get your first-year head coach. Get this. They ultimately – so here's two things with the NFL. I'm losing my – my ADD brain's kicking in. But here's two things. The NFL, in a way, it's like March Madness, and the draft is like a game of poker. I say March Madness for the perspective of, you know how everyone this time of year, like 2 weeks ago, goes, oh, these are the substances that's going to happen. Watch out for this team. But then the Oakland Grizzlies come along, and everyone's like, holy crap, look at the Oakland Grizzlies beating Kentucky. It's the same sort of logic with the NFL, where there's always that one team no one expects coming is going to come. It happens every year. And I say the poker hand of the draft. Why? Some hands you get shipped out. Some hands, you know what, you got a royal flush or you got a straight. The Houston Texans last year at the draft, they had a royal flush just lined up perfectly, and they knocked it down. That's where the Patriots, I'm skittish because, hey, you may not get that. Chicago, it's the same thing, too. I know everyone's high on Chicago. I'm high on Chicago from the sense of I think defense can help them win a couple games. You know, hey, low-scoring game, don't mess this up. We'll win you the football game. Patriots have done it for years, and we're going to move on now because this is where I think the New York Giants are going to be this year. There's going to be some – I think if they get into a shootout game – like what? Like you obviously remember 2015, right? Game against the New Orleans Saints. I think it was like 52-48 or 52-49.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the Giants are that kind of a team where, and this is not a knock on them in a way, but if they get into a track meet, I don't know how much they can keep up. You know, if it's a shootout, just tit for tat. But you get into a game like the Baltimore Ravens one of 2022, because that's a perfect example of how defense won them that game against the much superior opponent to them. Like I said, that's not a knock on the Giants or anything like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think the Giants have the defense now to where the line set, beautiful defensive line, Brian Burns, Dexter Lawrence, Kayvon Thibodeau. But one player on the Giants I really like is McFadden at linebacker because, to quote Carl Banks on Twitter, you now have a linebacker who doesn't need a map to read the field. So we'll see what they do in the secondary. We'll see what offense happens. When it comes to the New York Giants, though, I think they're that kind of team to where if you're getting into a track meet, I don't think you'll win. But if you're in a game that's like, you know, 14-10, I think the defense can do enough to hold down the fort.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And then on top, I mean, I think that if you look at this team right now, the Giants have a front seven that any team in the league, including playoff teams, would be happy to present. I think that it is an absolutely a playoff caliber defense. And I mean, for the first time, like we've got what looks like a pretty serious pass rush. And especially, you know, with Shane Bowden coming in as defensive coordinator, this is going to be a system that's going to allow Kayvon Thibodeau to accentuate his strengths a little bit more than in Wink Martindale's system, which I didn't even dislike with Wink Martindale's system. I thought that, you know, he coached a pretty good defense the last couple of years. All things considered.
Well, he only works for so long, though. That's the thing.
Yeah, exactly. He's very, you know, high risk, high reward. And it's very strange that you see a blitz heavy system where, you know, the edge rusher doesn't thrive. So I think that we should be hopefully moving to like a more, you know, traditional approach here. And I mean, the addition of Brian Burns on the other side, you've got Dex in the middle.
First.
Yeah. Okereke, Aziz coming back, right? Underrated piece. And then in the secondary, yes, losing Xavier McKinney sucks, but Jason Pinnock was a hell of a find. And Deontay Banks had a great rookie year. So I'm very optimistic from a defensive standpoint that they can definitely keep us within games. Of course, the defense was good last year too. And, we were in situations where it was like, you know, the offense just couldn't move the ball in half of our games last year. It was, you know, it's embarrassing. And, you know, you're in positions where you are either turning the ball over or giving the defenses short fields, defenses on the field for too long. So yeah, I mean, that was basically, you know, why the team wound up the way that they did. And yeah, to your point, this is absolutely not a team that's going to thrive in track meets. I mean, we don't know who's going to be quarterbacking this team. But it's either, you know, Daniel Jones, who's got a ton of question marks, or a rookie, most likely. So from that standpoint, you can only expect so much. And obviously, if we're going to get a premium weapon at wide receiver to beef up that room, it's going to come in the draft. So it's going to be a rookie. So this offense obviously is going to have some adjusting to do. I am optimistic it can be better than last year because last year was absolutely dreadful. And I'm now in the camp of anybody, whoever they have conviction of in this draft in terms of the quarterback position, I am confident can be an upgrade over what Daniel Jones was giving us. because even when he was healthy last year, Tyrod Taylor, and then the Cutlets, the playbook was more open with those guys than it was with your $40 million a year man in Daniel Jones. So I think that the organization is seeing that it's time to move on. And I think that they're, you know, they're trying to be fair about it when they've been asked about it in the media. But yeah, I mean, this is going to be a transitional year for the team. I do think that there's enough talent that we could potentially, like, glass half full, best case scenario, be a spoiler slash fringe contender, like maybe 7 or 8 wins if all goes perfectly. But you got to look at this as a transitional year.
Here's the thing I look at too, and this is going to be a take that I have. I know I have never been the biggest Daniel Jones supporter. I've been very vocal in a lot of his like play, and the fact that there's a lot of people out there who have the faith in him, believe in him, which I understand. He's your quarterback at the end of the day. You're a Giants fan.
Sure.
I think that for them drafting a quarterback is borderline irresponsible. And now I say that for a couple of reasons. One, you bring in, obviously you still have Cutlets there, but we learned quickly that flame extinguished. But you bring in Drew Lock as well. And you have him there. So what I'm trying to get at is give Daniel Jones, instead of pushing him to the curb and becoming what the New York Jets have had, where it's just, I don't want to play with you, we're sick and tired of you. I just think from a football standpoint, that sense of, you know, bringing in a quarterback, it's just going to do more damage to the locker room than good. And now here's what I'm getting at, though. Because you have the quarterback room solidified, but wide receivers have been a huge question mark for the New York Giants team pretty much ever since Odell Beckham Jr. left. I know they made the playoffs 2 years ago, but you know what I mean. There hasn't been that star there in 5 years going on 6. Malik Nabers is right there. Romo Dunze is right there. Get the little toy for Daniel to play with, but that if it doesn't work out, sayonara. Because next year there is the out in the contract. If you do it this year, it's just, I just think it brings that level of toxicity that you do not want to see in a locker room. It brings that like awkwardness stage. Because like, look for example, look what the Pittsburgh Steelers did. Kenny Pickett's in Philadelphia now, but Justin Fields, they shipped him off to Pittsburgh as soon as they came to that decision. Yeah. First overall, more than likely it's going to be Caleb Williams in about 22 days' time. But my thing with going back to the irresponsible point is, what good does it do for Daniel's development coming back from injury? What good does it do for this team and this organization to where, hey, it might look good on paper, but down the line when you're trying to build culture, what is it saying to them if you bring in a Drake May, what J.J. McCarthy, Michael Penix, doing that theirs to where it's now a, hey, this first rounder is expected to come in and take your job. Meanwhile, maybe you know what, if you fool around day 2, day 3, Spencer Rattler's there. Joe Milton, who if you ask him to throw 5 yards, he's going to chuck it 80 yards, is there. Keaton Slovis, Michael Pruitt from Tulane. Guys of that nature in Elk, why not go get one of those guys to where, hey, like what happened with the Dak Prescott situation where he beat Tony Romo, or a better one, 2012, Seattle Seahawks. They brought in Matt Flynn on an irresponsible contract. Russell Wilson was drafted, and look at what happened to Russell Wilson. So that's where I'm saying it. Hey, use the first round for something you need, not something you want. I feel like if they don't go quarterback, it'll piss the fan base off. But if they do go quarterback, some fans might be happy in the moment, but in the long-term repercussion of things, I just don't know how it's going to work out for the Giants. You know, build from within for now, and then eventually if it doesn't work next year, cut your losses and you move on.
So I think that that is a valid take, and you cited a lot of good examples from around the league of other teams that have had, you know, question marks at the quarterback position.
Yeah.
It's a tough thing to do in this league. You cannot win without, you know, a franchise quarterback. Now, not to say you have to have the best quarterback. It's got to be a guy that you have conviction on. Case in point, Brock Purdy. Brock Purdy is not an amazing quarterback by any means, but he's their guy. They've committed to him, right? So I think with the Giants right now, they've been trying this with Daniel Jones for many, many years. And I've been somebody who, you know, along with a lot of other people, have been critical of the Giants' decisions in terms of their head coach and general manager ever since the end of the Tom Coughlin and Eli Manning era, right? And now that we've got Joe Shane appears to be a guy who I think that he's made mostly quality decisions and seems like an intelligent person with a good finger on the pulse of where the league is in 2024. Brian Daboll, first-time head coach. He's not doing a perfect job, but I really can't look at last year and think, oh my gosh, what a terrible coach who just, you know, he really screwed the pooch and he cost the Giants all these games with his horrible coaching decisions and in-game management, like I would say about Pat Shurmur or Joe Judge. I can point to those guys and be like, yeah, y'all were in over your head, did not do a good job. Ben McAdoo did not do a good job. You couldn't really look at the Giants last year and think, oh, their coaches are the problem, you know? And I think, like, with Daniel Jones now burning through this many regime changes, it's like, at what point do we start to look at this guy and think, did he cost all of them their jobs by being this ineffective through multiple systems? Not that changing systems as frequently is ideal, but I feel like this guy has had chance after chance after chance after chance, and I was willing to give him one last one after 2022 because he took a step forward in Daboll's offense, got this team to the playoffs, had by far his best season in the pros, and then this year comes along. You've added Darren Waller, bringing back the same supporting cast that got you to the playoffs the year before, and before the injury, this guy was laying an absolute egg. We're talking like ineffective, cannot move the ball at whatsoever. And as I stated before, when we saw quarterback changes midseason due to injury, Tyrod Taylor and Tommy DeVito, the playbook was more open with those guys than it was with Daniel Jones. So I understand that he's under contract, but I really think you're in a position where you have a receiver-rich class, you have a quarterback-rich class. I think that they are – Joe, and also, going back to the, you know – people's jobs type thing. Joe Shane is now entering year three. Daboll entering year three. You had a playoff year, then you had a terrible year. Very good chance that if you completely crap out this year, people are calling for jobs. So I cannot see Joe Shane passing up the opportunity to pick his own quarterback. I cannot see this guy, his first general manager position in the league, with a guy that almost any other organization would not commit to. I cannot see Joe Shane putting his career in Daniel Jones' hands. I can't see him doing that. So maybe this means that, you know, you take a quarterback. No one is saying that when you have your camp battle, oh, Daniel Jones, he looks healthy. He's playing amazing. He's still going to be our starter because he looks great. You know, that could still be the case, but there is no way. I don't think there's any way you can roll into this season and not consider the opportunity to go with somebody else. And it's not Drew Lock. It's got to be a rookie in this class because there's too many options.
I know. I just, when I hear stuff like Drew Lock apparently being brought in on the promise of, hey, you might be in a competition come camp time, that's where I kind of get, that's where things kind of like mellow out. It could backfire, could do that. I just want to give that 2 cents just because, like, you know how you see dysfunctional teams do dysfunctional things all the time. Now, obviously, there was that report that came out about John Merrill wanting to keep Saquon last year. They're 2-6, and saying that, hey, trading him effectively does ruin your season. When in reality, you know what? It's what you should have done. The other option for the Giants here too. And I don't know how you or other Giants fans are going to take this. Trading back and building assets like what you did 3 years ago may not be the worst thing in the world, because look at what happened in 2022. Obviously, Kayvon Thibodeau has been really good. Evan Neal. I do not want to give my full on just like, yeah, he's a bust at right tackle just yet, because look at Andrew Thomas. His first 2 years he struggled. Year three is when he truly came out. I was always waiting for Andrew Thomas, because I have a rule. This is more or less with first rounders and then second to seventh, are if by year three it doesn't work out, you cut your losses and you say deuces. Meanwhile, with Evan Neal, that's what I'm not ready to do with there yet. Because, hell, you guys are in a position. You can go get a wide receiver day one or day two. You can go get a great offensive lineman to go help out, because it's, I believe, Andrew Thomas, John Michael Schmitz, and Evan Neal as three of your linemen. Jermaine Illuminor, very good, solid piece. But as well, if you can get some depth in there to, you know what, where, hey, when injuries do go down, it just adds to it. You know, it adds to it. So the Giants are in a very peculiar position right now, because when you look at the rest of your division, Philadelphia, I know they added Saquon Barkley, and we can get your thoughts on that in a second. But with Saquon, I'm not ready to, you know, with them, say, fully – oh, yeah, Philly's back. Roll out the red carpet because
– yeah.
I don't know if you know this, John. Nick Sirianni apparently was, like, this close to getting fired, and then they changed their minds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was this close to getting fired. I think Philadelphia is, too, because here's the thing with Philly. They lost two key off-the-field leaders this year. Jason Kelsey's retired. Fletcher Cox is retired. They lost Hassan Reddick. I know – I brought back C.J. Gardner-Johnson. They also – I can't think what else they did. I can't think of much else of what they did. They obviously paid Landon Dickerson some money. But Philadelphia is a team in question right now. It's where I don't know what to get from them. Then Washington, look, I don't think they're a quarterback away either. I know they were the most active in free agency. But everyone that they signed, it's kind of like, you know, they're guys. They're there. Like, nothing Washington did makes me really sizzle or pop about them.
Right. I would agree.
They basically did what the Patriots did 3 years ago, where it's, hey, we have money. We're going to go spend it on a bunch of guys that we think are going to be good. But in reality, Jeremy Chin's okay. Austin Eckler's on the back nine of his career. Let's be real. Is it a good 1-2 punch? Yes, but let's be real. Brian Robinson Jr. is the better back there. And the thing is, with quarterback, I don't know where they go. Cliff Kingsbury, we saw what happened in Arizona. It did not work out. I will still say this, too. If Patrick Mahomes doesn't become the quarterback that he is now, there is absolutely no way the Arizona Cardinals hire Cliff Kingsbury. He only got hired because everyone saw what Patrick Mahomes did and figured, you were his college coach, you're going to come here, you're going to do this with Kyler Murray. Yet, how many games in the playoffs have the Arizona Cardinals won since Cliff was hired and then fired? Zero with one appearance. That's where your division's up in smoke right now. There's one more team I want to touch on. That's Dallas. Yes. Because I've been holding this take for a while.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know how Jerry says, we're all in this year. We're going for it all. I honestly think that there is a part of Jerry Jones that is more than okay. Look, are they the laughing stock of the league and they love to be made and everyone points a finger and laughs at them? Absolutely. You love to do it more than anyone else. I love to do it. Why? Because it's fun.
Yeah.
But what if Jerry's whole MO is, hey, we're America's team. And for anyone saying, oh, Detroit's an America's team. No. Dallas Cowboys will always be America's team. There's a reason why they have a lot of primetime games. They have the highest rated game of the year at 4:30 on Thanksgiving Thursday. There's a reason that they're always in that spot because they were the first team to do it, and then they know that eyeballs are going to be on them. So what if Jerry's whole persona of all in is just, we're all in on being America's team. We're going to sell everyone on the idea of, hey, look at the Dallas Cowboys. The Dallas Cowboys are this team. They're here. They're great. They're going to win these games, but come playoff time, that's when they're going to lay an egg. That's where the Green Bay Packers are going to come in and embarrass us. That's where we're going to run a play with Ezekiel Elliott under center. That's where, you know, we're going to give Aaron Rodgers the ball back with 2 minutes left in AT&T Stadium with Cowboy fans celebrating. You know, that's where we're going to let Dalton Schultz not get his feet down in bounds in time. To where every year you get your fans' hopes up to where it's, this is the year. This is us. We them boys. Cowboys stand up. But how does it end? The same way it always does. With Stephen A. Smith laughing hysterically at you, wearing a cowboy hat saying,
how about them cowboys?
How about them cowboys? You know what I mean? So like, that's what I wanted to get off my chest about with Dallas, where it's more about you're the center. How do I say it, Dallas? Best way to describe them, the annoying rich girl who's just always asking for attention. It's the, hey, look at me. Like, you know, the whole, I don't know how much of a South Park fan you are, but
oh, huge. Okay.
Did you see the special with Prince Harry and Meghan?
Oh, recents? No. I'm more historical, but yeah, go ahead.
Basically, you have to go watch it because basically the whole thing was going around basically saying, we want privacy. And the second people stopped paying attention to them, they were annoying. The second they stopped is when they really started getting annoying and rubbing into people's faces. People were just like, we don't care. Until your fan base says, we don't care, Jerry's just going to continue to be where he is with the Dallas Cowboys. Go watch the episode. I recommend it for anyone out there who's a South Park fan. Hopefully you got the reference.
Sweet. Yeah. I totally agree with your assessment of the NFC East. The Cowboys to me are an easy analysis. I mean, I have the same thoughts on them every single year. It's like, to me, the Cowboys have been stuck in like a Groundhog Day loop, like ever since we were kids. 30 years. Right? Like, to me, this team is exactly the same as the Tony Romo team. The DNA and the regular season and postseason performance is exactly the same. Some years they're better than others. Yeah. Some years you're 9 wins. Some years you're 11. Some years you're really good. You got to 12 or maybe even 13. but the result is always the same. They always lose in the postseason in the same way. And it's like, I don't know what we're missing. We just can't get over the hump. And yeah, they're a threat in the regular season, but it's like, eh. And I mean, now they're obviously in a situation where it seems like they don't have any money because they didn't make any offseason moves whatsoever. But it's not enough for me to say, oh, they're going to be horrible. It's just more like, yeah, you know, they're a good team, but they're beatable.
They essentially are where Buffalo is right now. You know, them and Buffalo are in the same tier.
Yeah, I would say so. It's like Dak Prescott gets too much crap, but he also gets, like, not – what's the word? He gets too much crap, but he also gets too much praise at times because it's like, you know, he's fine. He's functional. He's good enough to be a franchise quarterback. Is he, like, elite? No. Is he a guy you're going to win a Super Bowl with? Probably not. Like, I think that we've just seen the peak of the Cowboys. Unless they did something just radically different in terms of, like, I don't know, maybe it's just getting an unstoppable running game because they have had a good one a couple of years ago. Like, but then again, Ezekiel Elliott was a top five back in the league at one point, and that didn't get him there. Receiving core, CeeDee Lamb and Amari Cooper at one point, didn't matter. Just same thing always seems to happen. Again, some years better than others. So, I'm expecting another wild card appearance from them this year, basically, which is like both a compliment and an insult, I guess. The Eagles, to your point, losing a lot of key pieces. Saquon, yeah, it's a fine addition, but I think that Saquon is going to be the same thing as the Giants, where it's like, especially with the Eagles and knowing how much of a hard time they have committing to running the ball. I do not think Saquon's going to be a bell cow back in Philly whatsoever. I think that he's going to get less touches than people might envision. Because here's the thing. The Eagles had DeAndre Swift last year. And yeah, it's easy for someone to go like, oh, well, of course Saquon is a better player than DeAndre Swift. But DeAndre Swift was putting up elite numbers at times with Philadelphia. He arguably could have had a super duper good season with them if they actually committed to giving him the ball, you know, on a weekly basis instead of just picking and choosing. So it's like, okay, you've shown me what your offense looks like with a running back that's running for 100 to 150 yards per game. Saquon Barkley is not going to run for 300 yards a game. So what exactly is the difference?
I think it's just like with Dallas, you have everything. You also have the defensive side of the ball with Micah Parsons. I'm excited to see what Mike Zimmer does there on defense. But with Philly, I'm going to say this right now. Do not draft Saquon Barkley as an RB1 in fantasy. Don't do it. I know we're still 4.5 months away from – look, for as much as I love football, goddamn it, I love fantasy football. But with Saquon, like, you know, because DeAndre Swift last year, he was like – a third, fourth, fifth round running back. I think even if you want to get Saquon Barkley in the second round, like, be my guest. But when I look at, like, the top running backs in the NFL for fantasy, I'm looking at the Christian McCaffreys. I'm saying this right now. Buy stock and be John Robinson. I think this is the year where he really pops.
New coach could definitely fix him.
It's more about coaching than who's quarterback there. It's just,
yeah, I misspoke. Not fixing, maximizing. Maximizing is a different word than fixing.
Maximizes value. Yes. Meanwhile, with Philly, the fact, too, that, yeah, it all fell apart because Dom was kicked off the sidelines, that's a massive red flag. I'm sorry, but the fact that your coach was losing his temper because his bodyguard wasn't there because his bodyguard decided to be, I'm a hero, I'm going to go touch Drake Greenlaw during a game, which, I'm sorry, when there's fights in the NFL, you let the players hash it out. If you're a sideline official, you do not have any business getting involved in that.
That's why I hate the Eagles type of moment. It's like that's just entitlement to the highest degree. And like, honestly, from a pro wrestling standpoint, it reminds me of people who aren't workers that try to act like they're, like, you know, part of the show. Like,
you know everything about the business when you don't know.
Yeah. Shit. Like, oh, I know everything. Like, I'll tell you this, like, you know what you should be doing in your band. It's like, dude, shut up.
Yeah. So, but my biggest red flag with Philly last year, honestly, I know they lost to some, they had some bad games out in the stretch, but the fact that you guys nearly came back on Christmas night when they had you left for dead at half.
Yep.
I'm sorry. Giants plus 13.5 that day. Wow. That in week 18, betting on the Giants. Big Rad and I had Giants plus 5 in week 18. But because that's something with the Giants. The Giants were like sneaky good. They were spread darlings last year. And with Philly, though, like, they had so many of these games, though, like, to where I look at Christmas, to where I'm like, okay, hey, you looked like the Eagles of old. Like, it was like, hey, the Eagles are back. But the fact, too, you did – like, the fact, too, that they almost lost. The fact that you let Kyler Murray coming into your own building and beat you. You know? There are all these little things with Philly to where I'm just like, you got – you looks like – I'll be honest with you. When I look at the NFL as a whole, I look at four teams right now that have – like, that I label as true Super Bowl threat. And those are the four teams that were playing on Conference Championship Sunday last year. Kansas City, Baltimore, Detroit, San Francisco. Besides those four – every other team that was involved in the playoffs last year or in the NFL as a whole, minus – I don't even want to say there's a team that's really, like, you know, out of it, but I like I do, but I don't want to say that, you know? Right. Like, the only teams, like, I would picture, like, probably don't have a chance to win the Super Bowl would be, like, Tennessee, New England, Carolina, and the Cardinals. You know, besides that, I'm not saying everything won the shot, but those are the teams – I'm going to say, like, for sure right now, I could confidently say, hey, you're probably not making it to Super Bowl Sunday. Now, that's right. Not for every other team saying out there, but, like, the teams you can make cases for where it's like, hey, they're in multi-year rebuilds, where New England, we know what's going on there. With Carolina, I think it's finally, hey, you know, we're getting our shit right. We're signing some proper pieces. We're getting Bryce Young protection to where they also hired the good head coach. And then Arizona's another one I want to touch on.
Mm-hmm.
I know Jonathan Gannon got laughed at a lot last year for that speech. Do you know the one I'm talking about? Do you remember the one where he's like, did you take the bus here? Did you drive? Do you have that fire in your gut where it was just like
an awkward
speech? But mm-hmm. The fact that a bad team got bought, like basically they remind me of like the early Detroit Lions, you know, where, hey, they're not good, but they're buying into what the coach is selling them. They have a hard-nosed coach. Which, actually, there's a fun fact about the defensive coordinator of the Arizona Cardinals, and it ties into wrestling.
Yep.
The Arizona Cardinals defensive coordinator's brother is the wrestler. I don't know his real name, but his stage name in WWE was Riddick Moss.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah, I learned that recently just by everything. Where, yeah, it was – yeah, because I, like, looked at the two of them. It's like, yeah, this is his brother. I think his name is Matt, but – so Riddick Moss's brother is a defensive coordinator for the Arizona Cardinals, who's also born.
I just wikied that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a fun little fact that I learned. So, like, that's how I look at those teams with the NFL. But then going back to Philly, like, hey, they can do the tush push all they want, which I'm going to say this right now. Oh, they have Jalen Hurts. It could look the same. No, I'm telling you right now, that loss of Jason Kelce is going to be felt. I think he'll still be around the team to where, like, hey, you know, he's going to be with them and everything like that. I listened to New Heights where he was basically saying, hey, he still goes to the facility, works out. You're going to miss that off-field leadership and that passion. Because when Jason Kelce spoke, you listen. Same thing with Fletcher Cox, too. Like, there's, like, basically that 2018 team is a Brandon Graham away from being totally different than what it was, you know? Which I still think Brandon Graham's probably going to retire after this year. And for everyone saying, oh, you hate how you wish to retire on people. Guys, let's be honest. It's just you when you know, you know. And one other point I want to add on right now for fantasy football, and this is a take that I have. Don't draft Travis Kelce too early in fantasy football, and I have a reason for this.
Mm.
It's not because he's old. It's not because I'm saying, oh, he's washed. But what if Travis Kelce's whole objective right now is, hey, Travis, regular season, you don't have to go crazy hard. You can still put up great numbers, but what if they just sit him down and basically say, hey, we need you for, I don't know, 3 to 4 games in the beginning of the year. January, February, that's where you shine the most. So that's where I'm looking at it. So, like, you know, that whole, like later years players where it's just like, hey, regular season, coast along. That's why I think they went on. Obviously, look, they needs a receiver now, especially too, because for some reason the receiver's like, again, the car accidents in Dallas. But.
Oh, man. You totally got ahead of my hit and run one-liner, but sure, go on.
you know what I mean, though? Like, the fact that unfortunate incident happened. But then with Kelce, like with Hollywood Brown now, at first I was kind of like, about it. But then at the same time, too, Hollywood Brown could go there, have a career year, and either re-up and sign a deal, or he can do the Juju Smith-Schuster where he goes somewhere else and gets paid irresponsibly by a team that shouldn't have paid him, which now I hate myself for saying that. So
I think, I mean, Hollywood, I think he's a nice piece for them, but I think he's like a number three. I think they're looking at him like, I think that if you're KC, you got to add like a big bodied wide receiver down to offset all these like, you know, little speedy guys. I think that like, that's probably what they're looking to do in the draft, if I'm being honest, right?
I had one take back at like the beginning of January, like, or not beginning of January, like end of January, beginning of February. I really think they should have made a run at Mike Evans. I really do.
Yeah. No. Oh, he would have been perfect for them. There were a lot of people that were mocking. Actually, before he re-signed with the Bucks, there were a lot of people that were mocking him over there.
You know why? Like, it would have sucked for the NFL, but you know how much fun that would have been?
Oh, yeah. You kidding? Yeah, getting, like, Mahomes a true WR1. I mean, don't get me wrong. Rasheed had a great rookie year. But, like, in terms of a true, like, WR1, yeah, like, that would have been it.
Who might I add is one of the more, I think is the most underrated and underappreciated wide receiver in the NFL.
Yeah. No, I mean, and he put up incredible numbers with, incredible numbers.
1,000 yards every year of his career.
Yeah.
Like, he's one of those players that when he retires, he will be going to the Hall of Fame. Like, you know, there's no question about it. He will be a Hall of Famer, which, right. Since I finished recording, actually, you know what? Aaron Donald retired. Sayonara. Like, that was a move I couldn't believe either, just because obviously folks haven't recorded in a while, I'm trying to remember when Aaron Donald retired, but the fact that they basically had to post, like, quarterbacks, like, praise, and, even the Geno Smith, oh my God, video too, just shows how much of a menace he was in his career.
Right.
Yeah. But no, this, honestly, I like recording at this time of the year, but I don't just because, like, this is that, like, awkward period now, like, where there's no news. Oh, yeah, here's the biggest tidbit of the day. So, two things I want to talk about quickly. The hip drop tackle, I just want to say this. They basically just went too far with it. You know how college football right now, they basically are expanding from 4 to 12? It's the same equivalent. Like, you could have just taught it how to do it safer or not done a, hey, we're going to give you automatic 15 yards because – it's going to happen in a playoff game where someone gets hip drop tackled, and it's the difference between winning and losing a playoff game. I guarantee you that's going to happen.
Yeah, no, and I mean, we saw so many injuries resulting from that last year. That, like, you know, it's not surprising for them to make the call. This is a good move. I mean, at the same time, it's hard to do though. Like. I know it's like, I mean, this is live action, right? You know, trying to control your body movement and everything. And like, but I mean, we did see a consistent pattern. So, I mean, it was kind of a tough spot for the league, but I think ultimately, like, you know, nixing it was the right decision.
And I know we do all this stuff on player safety, but then it was also announced that, hey, Christmas is on a Wednesday this year, but the NFL was like, we're going to play anyway.
Right. The scheduling standpoint. Yeah. I mean, that, again, a fair, very fair argument.
Which, do I love that they're playing on Christmas? And there's that one, I don't know if you saw this, but there's that tweet that basically is like, I'm going to pull that up from Field Gates, where he basically tweeted that there's a stretch in December of just the amount of football that's going to be played. Where is this? Football Gods W, because Field Gates last week on the 26th, starting Christmas Day, we'll have this week-long stretch. December's 25th, 26th, 28th, 29th, and 30th are NFL games. The 31st is the college football quarterfinals, and then New Year's Day is another round of the quarterfinals. Do I love it from a fan standpoint? Absolutely. Am I concerned from a player safety standpoint, too? 100%. Why? Yeah. Because at the end of the day, this is what it's about, but I'll be honest with you. I love the fact, though, that the NFL looks at the revenue, and then if you look at, hey, we can put two random teams on Christmas Day. People are going to watch. Like this year, I'll remember this so vividly. The mom was like, we're not going to spend the whole day watching football on Christmas. Guess what was on all day long? Football.
Yep.
Football's king for a damn reason. And the fact, too, that the day that the NBA markets around, this is our day. The NFL's just come in the last few years. And I say this, too, with the pandemic that happened 4 years ago. We quickly learned that you can play football 7 days a week. We learned that with games being played on Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Fridays, which Christmas Day next – no, and then next year's on a Thursday, and then it's on a Friday, and then it's on a Saturday. So, like, the next 3 years after that, it doesn't have to worry. But so here's the thing. It's not a triple header. It's only a double header, which I do like. And I'll say this, too. If they want to make it easy, just put two divisional games on there. They, you know, just make it easy. Just, like, you know, throw out, like, how this year you had the Giants and the Eagles on there, and you had the Raiders and the Chiefs. Just do something like that again on Christmas Day. But all I know is that, hey, more football, the better, right?
Right.
Which I also firmly believe that 17 games is a roadmap. 18's coming. I think 18 games is coming.
Yeah, you need an even number. 17 is just awkward, you know?
I know. I think they're just doing it to see how it goes. And then eventually, like next time they go to bargain, it's going to be, hey, we're going to 18, which I will still say this. I think if they go to 18, I think you have to make an argument for an expanded playoff. I think you do have to introduce eight teams conference into the playoffs. That way half the league makes it in every year, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that I think that sweet, like six was really the sweet spot, if I'm being honest. These odd numbers, they're awkward, you know?
And also bring back two buys as well, because even second play, that race for the second buy is just, it's so crucial. It's just so, it's fun.
Yeah. I mean,
that's all.
Yeah. No, totally agree with that.
But you know what? That is another reason why you're here. This weekend, we got WrestleMania.
We do.
The 40th edition of WrestleMania. I know it's, I find it interesting that it's in Philadelphia. I know there's some people, like Nick Khan was talking today about how, why is it in Philly? Apparently the decision was made years ago, which I still find weird considering next year hasn't been announced yet, even though I feel like we know where it's going, Minnesota.
Mm, yeah.
But they're excited to go there. It looks like the city's excited and embracing it. Are you going or?
No, not going. I had thought about it. Unless something radically changes at the last moment, I'll just be watching from home. I didn't have anything going on in terms of, like extra work or anything like that. And just looking at ticket prices, they were pretty high. So just hanging out. I mean, I had something at one point in the Philly area on Sunday, which had kind of basically changed at the last minute. So that would have been for Sunday only. But I'm going to be local instead.
You know what? I have this thing too called a home that I'm looking to buy in the next few months, and those aren't cheap at all. So you know what? when you get older in life, you got to pick and choose where you spend your money.
100%, man.
But here's the thing: I've noticed a couple things just with WrestleMania. Recently, people are doing this for the Sundays because obviously there's the huge tag team match Saturday with Seth and Cody taking on Roman and The Rock, and then Sunday everyone's doing these. This is the thing about. Like, look, do I love being a wrestling fan? Yes. Has it brought me this podcast? Yes. Has it brought me friendships like the ones I have with Jared, Danny, Big, even though we're Danny and I are more football than wrestling. Big Rat, Markeem, Phil, and hell, even friends out there like RKLU from 7WO, shout out Justin, Robbie, et cetera, has brought me those friendships? Absolutely. But there's a point with wrestling where I see people fantasy booking stuff where it's like, oh, if this happens, this happens, this happens. And it was Ross who tweeted about it today, where it's just like, and I literally said to him, I'm just like, people who do this, I just feel like you set yourself up for disappointment. You know, where you go into them, you basically, it's like how we're talking about football, where there's all these teams where, hey, people get way ahead of expectations. They think that, hey, we're the best, we're going to do this, to where when you don't, it's disappointing. It's the same thing with wrestling, where people can fantasy book the hell out of a show. And if it doesn't go your way or there's like these crazy scenarios don't come true, it just leaves you disappointed when it's like, oh, that sucked. No, in reality, it only sucked because you had way too high expectations for this. Am I saying for Sunday have high expectations? No, I'm not saying that. Absolutely. I have high expectations for the show. But I don't want these crazy scenarios coming in where it's like, hey, Roman's beating Cody, The Rock comes out. Oh, and here comes Stone Cold Steve Austin. Here comes Solo. So here comes John Cena. I'm like, no, they can appear in the show, but they don't have to do goofy shit to ruin a match where at the end of the day, no matter if Roman wins or if Cody wins, we're still going to enjoy it. That's the thing, too. Like when people were complaining about when Rock came out, I never thought we were getting Roman versus Rock, which I will say this, them making Rock a heel was the best thing they could have done. It was amazing. 100%.
It's a very read the room move. And it's not even just that because, like, so if you compare it to, like, 2014, right, with Daniel Bryan and Batista and the route they went, But it was absolutely the right kind of story to tell, given the climate at the time. In terms of Batista and Randy Orton's like heel characters at the time, they were there to be obstacles to, get Daniel Bryan more over, essentially.
Yeah.
The Rock has transcended that, where Cody Rhodes is 100% the protagonist of the story, but The Rock is an attraction in and of himself. And his whole final boss persona is a reinvention of himself for like this next generation who, you know, obviously here's the thing that people often overlook. there was a lot more people out there that don't realize that The Rock was ever a pro wrestler, because The Rock's full-time WWE run ended in 2003. It's now 2024. The Rock's Hollywood career has lasted for two decades now. So there are a lot of people that have seen The Rock's movies that I've talked to, and they're like, oh, he was a wrestler? Really? They didn't know that. Because originally, if you remember, The Rock's movies, when he first started out, weren't exactly – they were terrible, and they were not big smash hits whatsoever. So people – they were – you know, he was kind of some people, you know, looked him a bit of a laughing stock, like, oh, this wrestler thinks he wants to try acting. But now it's, like, completely reversed. So tracing back to where we're at right now, this reinvention for the current audience, like, you've got – there is a – you saw that there's a lot of people there. This era of wrestling fan that's, like, super plugged into Cody Rhodes as their conquering hero, there's a reason that he was so – that The Rock was so quickly booed when it was teased that that was going to be the match between him and Roman. So, like I said, it's a very read-the-room move on WWE's part, and it's created some really awesome television and really high anticipation for this year's WrestleMania. I mean, this tag match, you could argue the show is pretty much entirely built around this one angle, and it's absolutely on fire. You know, this is just great content right here. Everybody's doing a great job.
So my thing with The Rock thing too is I just didn't like when everyone was pissed off about it, where I was just like, someone tweeted out where they basically, dude, shut up. You're going to watch the show. That's the thing with this WWE. You can bitch and bitch and bitch. And I know there's the whole stuff right now where it's like, oh, people who like one brand of wrestling, people who like another brand. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole just because, look, we could do it all day where, look, obviously AEW, WWE, where people like they have their own things. Regardless, WrestleMania is that one event a year you're always going to watch. You're always going to tune in. It's like the Royal Rumble. It's the same thing. You're always going to watch it because why? WrestleMania is that drug that brings every wrestling fan back to WWE, no matter where you are in your life. You could be not be watching wrestling anymore. You know when WrestleMania is happening. Meanwhile, with this Rock Final Boss character, just the fact that he's back to wearing these ridiculous outfits, even the fact, too, that he does the whole thing, where it's, instead of acknowledging, it's like he holds the L out and stuff like that. Yeah. The fact that they had him beating the shit out of Cody in the parking lot in the rain. The fact, too, that he's coming out and just dropping F-bomb after F-bomb and, cursing's off the table. Like, you know, he doesn't care what he says. He doesn't give a shit. So when you have this, it's just going to make those memories to where, hey, and I'll say this, too. The fact, too, that he's selling some of the stuff for Monday night, like he's working for his next paycheck, is incredible and showing that this business is in his blood. It's showing that, you know, everything he's got going for him. Like, I'm going to say this right now, and I know everyone out there, too, is like, people are going to lose interest if Cody loses. No, there's going to be a section. I think there's just going to be a section of the fan base, though, that's going to be, last year was disappointment. This year is going to be pissed off. I'm going to compare it to, like, the Patriots and Giants Super Bowls. The first time it happened, you didn't expect it to happen. The second time, though, it really stung a lot. I still say that. The 46 stings more than 42 because that's a redemption arc. Mm-hmm. Where if Cody doesn't get his redemption arc, I don't think people are going to completely quit on WWE, but I think it's going to be very hard for people to get their trust earned back. Meanwhile,
I would agree with that. I don't think that you can. And I mean, yes, like it's wrestling. You know, they can tell whatever kind of story they want to tell, go in whatever direction they decide to go because they control the narrative. But in terms of, you know, just you think just classic wrestling booking, I don't think that you can have a high profile babyface win the Royal Rumble 2 years in a row and lose to the same guy at WrestleMania 2 years in a row. And yeah, I think at that point, you just at some point you have to reward the fans for their faith and give them a payoff. I think anybody who's been watching wrestling long enough knows when you've been seeing, typically the television is giving you clues. Like when you're seeing the babyface get demolished on TV, on the go home show, it's usually an indicator that they're up at the pay-per-view. And I know that, like, listen, Roman Reigns has been the champion for 3.5 years. Obviously the WWE has not shied away from finding ways to extend this title reign and having him win matches where maybe you can think, oh, this is the babyface that's going to use the rub. But I think that he's been the champion for so long. Cody Rhodes is obviously over at a high enough level to take the belt from him to where, like, it would feel like, all right, this is earned, you know, because why do you build up a monster heel? So that you can make the babyface that beats him. So you want to, you know, find a guy that's worthy to carry the torch. I think Cody is totally that guy. And again, going back to the 2 years in a row type thing, I don't think that they would be running it back again if they weren't going to do a title change. And really, I think that you could have made just as strong of an argument last year, and it was solidified after the fact, because if you look at Roman Reigns, his title reign was at its absolute peak at last year's WrestleMania. Absolutely. Because this guy was coming off of his hottest title defenses, his best matches, highest profile opponents, headlining pay-per-views every single month. And then what happened after WrestleMania last year? All of a sudden, his schedule cuts back a little bit. He had only a handful of title defenses since then. And I think it really reeked of WWE is now kind of running out of people for him to face, it looked like. So it's like, all right, so now our course correction is going to be how we're going to do this is we're just going to stretch out his programs. So the whole thing with Jey Uso stretches all the way to SummerSlam to find, I think that was his first, one-on-one title defense since WrestleMania last year. Right. And then LA Knight, I think it might've been because
I was saying I was at SummerSlam though. I don't know if you know that or not.
Oh yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
So yeah, then after, you had the Jey Uso thing, right? And then after that, LA Knight, which was a lightning in a bottle, like he was just unbelievably over and you had to do something. Yep. So that was another thing. And then you move to...
four-way.
Right? Yeah. Four-way at the Rumble, right?
Yeah, that's what it was. The four-way at the Rumble. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but yeah, it was the four-way at the Rumble, and then it was because that was the thing too. Like the fact that you had this whole thing with Cody, where it's like The Rock's coming back. It's like, oh, they're just gonna let Cody go by the wayside. Uh-huh. I still think that this Mania has had to do some juggling with injuries. Like I think we were expecting to get a Punk Rollins, but instead we've gotten a hell of a run by Drew McIntyre. But going, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but like you're right in everything you said. To where if you look last year on the road to WrestleMania, beats Kevin Owens at Royal Rumble. Sami Zayn in Montreal, obviously that was the big money match at the time. And then, because here's the thing, what I love about wrestling, or what I don't love about wrestling, is when something's just predictable, when you know what's going to happen. Like, look at last year, everyone thought, this is it, Cody's getting the story done, Cody's going to win. Cody loses. 28, like, it's kind of like that Rock-Cena angle from a perspective, but the only difference is I feel like 28, everyone kind of knew the Rock's probably going to win. Rock wasn't coming back just to put over someone. Rock was coming back to, be the one to go over.
Mm-hmm.
So this year, I think it's different now to where, hey, Roman can go away for a bit. You can potentially set him up with a building to next year's WrestleMania if they really want to do the Tribal Chief and the Final Boss. But even the fact, too, that like they knew when to pivot. Like, because I always used to say with the show, like, they have WWE logic because... For a long time there, I was getting into a habit where this always happened with WWE. The pay-per-view is supposed to be fantastic. It looks beautiful on paper. WrestleMania 34 is the bright example. It was terrible. It was just weird booking decisions. It was just all this stuff.
Yep.
And then the last 2 years have been a breath of fresh air. That's why I trust Triple H. And I trust him to the sense of, hey, he's going to do the right thing. He's going to do this. Because the main thing with Saturday, too, is and Sunday – there's not really been any new champions if you look at it. Like, from the women's perspective, Rhea and Io have held the belts for a very long time.
Correct.
Logan Paul's had the belt for 5 months. Gunther's had the belt for almost 2 years, for the love of God. I can't believe I almost forgot about Gunther. Tag titles for 6 months, Seth for almost a year, to where if some of these title changes happen, it's going to be a holy crap moment. But the fact that Sunday night can end with Cody in the ring in Philadelphia... Which, him holding the title up, you're going to leave the fan base happy. And then guess what? It's this whole new cycle to where you can have him face someone else. You can have him do this. The only complaint I've seen from certain people about the show is that they basically posted, I think it was the AJ Styles LA Knight match, which, and Jimmy versus Jay, where it's like, these matches don't need to happen. Get more women on there. To which I say, Jimmy versus Jay has been long-term booked for about 8 months now. The second that Jimmy cost Jay at at SummerSlam the title, we knew what was happening at Mania. We knew that's going to be a high-profile Mania. Low-key, I think low-key banger alert. Like, there's honestly, I think, two or three matches I don't even want to say on this card are going to be bad, but they're going to be the cool-down matches. I look at the Philadelphia Street Fight. I look at the six-women tag. And even, I don't want to blank on anything else. And even the tag team ladder match to where, are they probably going to be the best? No. So don't expect them to be the best. If you want the matches, if you want the matches you think they're going to be good, I look at Rhea versus Becky, even though I'm not ready for Becky. I'm not ready for Becky to be champ again. Rhea's my girl. I've been a Rhea Ripley since 2017.
And I don't think that Becky would go over either. I think that like Becky going over would have been more of a Vince call from years ago. But I think that right now it's very clear that, you know, Becky is in this match to give Rhea a high profile opponent to defend against. But it's very obvious to me that nobody in the women's division is on Rhea's level right now in terms of, you know, being over. And I can't see her losing the title until they at least do a rematch with Charlotte after last year's Mania. I think that they've given the feud a little bit of juice with the promos the last couple of weeks, but I wouldn't cast much doubt in terms of Rhea retaining. There's probably a higher likelihood of a title change for Io Sky versus Bayley to legitimize the women's Royal Rumble a little bit. Yeah, I think that there's, and also Bayley's like the one girl from the initial crop of the NXT women that hasn't had
a moment.
Her WrestleMania moment. So I could totally see that being a thing. I think that the card's pretty well balanced, you know? I mean, I think I love the format. I love this two-night format the last several years. I think that they finally got it absolutely right. And some people might think that for, you know, 4 hours per night, you're only doing six or seven matches. But you have WrestleMania pageantry. You have the entrances. You have the video packages. You have the fact that these matches are getting more time than normal pay-per-views or premium live events, as they're now called. And then you also have you got some segments in between. And it's just so easily digestible. This is coming after we had that really brutal stretch from WrestleMania's 32 through 35, where, this is before I like got a little bit more seriously involved in the business, but I was like ready to call off the annual Mania trips just because, the show was becoming such a drain to sit through for like 8 hours straight. You're in this stadium. And I mean, could you imagine that if it was in Philadelphia in April? It's been, you know, horrible weather this week. I think that, if you were in that stadium for like, 10 hours at a time, you're asking a lot out of your audience. So I think that breaking it up into two nights, it just, people come back the second day, they're energized, they're ready for round two. And I think that they've totally nailed this format.
So my main thing of the Mania is there because obviously the four that you mentioned, guess who went to three of the four of them? Me right here. Because when I look back at all those trips, 32, I know a lot of, because there's a lot of people we're friends with, and this is not a shot at anyone, but I think a lot of people overhyped the trip and thought, this is going to be the greatest WrestleMania ever, Dallas, Texas, AT&T Stadium. The group's all back together, considering a lot of people didn't go to 31 because, like, no one really thought 31 was going to be anything special. In terms of it's one of the best Manias of all time.
Yep.
But 32 for me, it was like I enjoyed it just because it was my second Mania of all time. Like 28 was my first. But with 32, it was just when you look back on it, it was a lot of weird booking decisions, like very predictable. Charlotte winning the title when Sasha should have gone over that night.
Not enough babyface moments on that show.
Yeah, Ryder getting the weird rub with the Intercontinental title where everyone's just like, what the hell? And then 33, the same thing too, where, look, you had Brock Lesnar winning the title, which is very predictable. Taker and Roman didn't deliver. You had the Hardy Boys return. And Bayley won the Fatal 4-Way, but like that's where I was saying with Bayley's WrestleMania moment. Like, if you look at all the other women, like, Charlotte's had countless moments at Mania. Becky had Mania 35. I'm trying to think if Sasha has or not, but Sasha, like I said,
She was winning.
In the triple threat.
She was in the triple threat, and then her and Bianca main evented in Tampa. And I know that Mania people are a little weird on because we were like halfway out of COVID, but it was still the
first.
That was
a great match, though.
It was a great match, and she can say main event of the first WWE show in front of a live crowd in over a year. First major wrestling show in front of a crowd, with COVID. So there's a historic quality to it for sure.
But also to the fact that it was two women of BIPOC, two black women main eventing at WrestleMania. I know that I'm not trying to get political or anything, but like that's got to feel special. Like, you know, the fact that, hey, we're two, not only were we women, but we're women of color. That's that. Because that's the thing.
Michael Cole called it out on commentary that night. Yeah, no, that was definitely a big moment for sure.
Who I will say this to, I know everyone likes to rag on Jim Ross lately because he's kind of at the end of his career. Michael Cole's only gotten better with age. I know, dude, Michael Cole's been great, yeah, but he's been on a roll these last few years.
100%. And to me, like, I think that it was starting to become apparent. There were certain WWE shows that were taking place when they were first doing international shows. They were kind of more like glorified house shows in the sense that the storylines, there is continuity, but for the most part, those cards were straight up about wrestling. Yeah. On the network. And I noticed on those shows, I was like, oh, it's almost like Michael Cole's being fed less notes than usual. Like, he doesn't have Vince McMahon screaming in his ear. It's almost like he was told, oh, you can just go out and call this show as like normally. And I think with Triple H's leadership, you're seeing a lot more of that. And I think WWE commentary is not what people think it is, especially during the Vince McMahon era, where it's like, it's not that these guys are trying to come up with all of these catchphrases and buzzwords on their own. They're wearing headsets and they're being told what to say the entire time. If Vince McMahon is screaming in your ear, telling you to say something, you're gonna say it. And so if something ever came across as unnatural or it doesn't, it's okay to say that, yeah, this wasn't a good experience for me as a viewer, but I think that it's very clear that overly scripted commentary versus more leeway commentary are like night and day.
Yes, exactly. Because that's the thing too, where there's that trust factor from Triple H where it's like, you know, there's a micromanaging boss and there's a non-micromanaging boss. Triple H is the boss that knows, hey, these guys know, you know, I'm going to swear, these guys know what the fuck they're doing. We don't have to tell them to do their job. We don't have to give them buzzwords. Because sometimes, you know what? Like, when a Michael Cole moment happens naturally, when it happens organically, it just makes it better. Instead of it being, like, force-fed to you. Right. The only thing I was going to say, too, with the Mania trips, 34, New Orleans, was a great time. New Orleans is a great city. That's, like, one of the cities where if Mania goes to, like, I'm there. But that show, too, by the end of the show, because we all knew what was coming, everyone was just tired. Like, the match comes off as terrible on TV. That's because you had a stadium full of 75,000 people that were just ready to go home. Like, you know, we were fed bad booking with, like, like Charlotte winning, which, like, I never didn't agree with, like Nakamura losing and then turning heel. And then, like, we all knew the predictability of Roman beating Brock and getting hit with, I think it was like 7 F5. So, excuse me, it was just like by the end of the show, everyone was just like, okay, cool. Can we go home now? Can we leave? Can we go back to Bourbon Street? You know. So,
yep.
That was that with that Mania. But then ever since then, like, there really hasn't been a bad Mania. And also, be honest with you, I don't know if this was me just not believing it or what, but the two night Manias, I heard that at first it was because of COVID. But I also heard about the whole New Japan stuff. I think it was. I always thought like, hey, you know, COVID, everyone's at home two nights. But then I feel like with two nights, the New Japan Wrestle Kingdom thing may have a factor, but it's also, hey, we can sell more tickets, we can make more money, the more money, you can get more people on the card. And here's the thing, too. I don't like the people do this already, that everyone goes, oh, night one looks so much better than night two. Let the nights happen, and then we can make our decisions Sunday night at around 11:30. Okay, people? That's the thing. And the other thing about that WWE does that I love, sorry to cut you off again, Saturday pay-per-views are so much better than Sunday, because Saturday you don't have that dread of going to bed and then waking up early to go to work.
Yep, no, I completely agree. I think that's what made last year's night one the stronger front to back card. But I think that I try to look at the WrestleManias like collectively, holistically. You know, speaking to the first point about the two night format and how it started, I kind of got the sense that they were going in that direction it was a couple of things. Number one, it was the extremely long WrestleManias between the 2 to 3 hour pre-show followed by a 5 hour main card for like 4 years in a row. That was obviously, I think that people knew it was unsustainable and it was killing the live crowd. And number two, WrestleMania weekend has been an event now for about 15 years with all of these other promotions coming to town, all these other events happening. Obviously, things are different now because, like, you know, when it was Ring of Honor, you know, during the peak of their run and all of the other indies like Evolve and everyone else like kind of piggybacking. Obviously, things have changed now in that regard. But WWE would then do NXT takeovers. And between the indie shows and all of WWE's events, the Hall of Fame, it was very clear that wrestling fans had the appetite to make WrestleMania weekend, not just WrestleMania for one night, WrestleMania weekend an overall experience. And at that point, it became, okay, well, obviously these fans are okay watching show after show after show. So what is the harm in making that Saturday show like day one of WrestleMania?
Yeah,
none. It's been very well received. We're now like 4 years into this, if you count Tampa as the first one. And the appetite is totally there. And also from a tourism standpoint, people who travel for WrestleMania are there for the whole weekend anyway.
Hell, my trips were the whole week. Like I did Dallas, New Orleans. I was there from Wednesday to Tuesday, and then Orlando for 33. I was there Wednesday to Wednesday. I was there for a full 7 days. So that's the thing too, where you have people coming to your city. You have people doing stuff. Like some of my greatest memories from those wrestling trips were like on the Tuesday in Orlando, we went to Universal Studios. Monday in New Orleans, we were walking around Jackson Square. We were walking around the city exploring. Like those are where those memories are made. Like the wrestling is a huge reason why you're there, but it's everything outside of wrestling that can really make to it and bring lifelong friendships like we have. Ready to go down this card? We'll do a little rundown, see what we think is going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
Rhea versus Becky.
Prediction now, Rhea.
Mommy's on top.
Yep, mommy's on top.
Gunther versus Sami Zayn.
I like Gunther here. This could, you know, some people speculated that Chad Gable should have been in the spot over Sami Zayn because of the week-to-week TV. I could see this being one of those where you might see Gunther just go to town on Sami Zayn and to where he may like really, really beat him down after the match is over and lead to like a moment with Chad Gable. I don't think you do like an on the spot like type thing, but it can totally lead into like the next pay-per-view.
So my thing with this is just, look, obviously stuff has happened. I think we were robbed of what would have been a absolute banger between Gunther and Lesnar. If that was the match to happen, like, oh my God, those two would have killed it. Obviously, look, things have happened and we're not getting that. Look, I don't want to get into all that stuff because we already know what happened or may have or have not. Look, we just know it's all allegations at this point. My thing is, for as much as I love Sammy, I just don't believe that he's the one to, like, you know how Cody can be set up to take down Roman. I don't think when I look at who's going to dethrone Gunther, I think it needs to be made a big deal. It's not a knock on Sammy. You know, you need the right person considering Gunther's hold this title since for almost 2 years. For almost a full 2 years, Gunther's had this title.
That's
where I'm picking Gunther.
I agree as well because I think that Sami Zayn is he is over enough to do it. But so remember, this is the Intercontinental Championship. So Sami Zayn won, right? Yeah, so he won the main event of WrestleMania Night 1 last year for the tag titles, right? He has challenged for the heavyweight title, you know, either world title on numerous occasions. He's very popular. He's got a good amount of credibility. He's never been the champion, but people see him as like a main event level threat. The Intercontinental title would be perfect for a guy like Chad Gable. If they want to make him, they want to try to elevate him. He's the type of guy who could benefit from beating Gunther. If Sammy wins, it would be like, okay, that's a nice moment for Sammy, but did he need it? No, because he's kind of like, he's at the level, he's established already. It's a nice moment for him, but it doesn't feel like an elevation.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I feel like if this was Chad Gable, I would seriously consider him being the one to dethrone Gunther. Even if it was Brock Lesnar, I don't know how that goes, but I feel like if it was Brock Lesnar and Gunther, he'd probably have Lesnar putting him over. Judgment Day, DIY, Awesome Truth, New Day, A-Town Down Under, and the New Cash Republic in a six-pack team ladder match. I'm going to call this match as it is right now. I do think Awesome Truth wins. Do I think they should? No. But all I care about with this match is be a 10 to 15 minute spot fest where some crazy shit happens, and I will be happy with it.
Yeah, so there was a YouTuber. He's a newer YouTuber. He laid out, and I'm on the site right now trying to get his username. Because okay, Mr. Santi Zap, you know that channel?
Yeah, he's from Toronto. He's from the area.
Oh, there you go. I thought he looked Canadian. So yeah, he's from Canadian. I was actually watching he did a WrestleMania predictions video the other day, and he mentioned a very good point that the rules for this match are that the match doesn't end until both sets of tag titles have been claimed, right? Yeah. So this sets the stage for potentially splitting the tag titles into. They have two world titles right now. They have US, they have Intercontinental. They have two women's titles. Yep. And yeah, it would only make sense for the tag titles to follow suit, where you may wind up with two teams victorious in this match. I think that, and also Damian Priest has the Money in the Bank. And you've got Dominic Mysterio in a match that does teaming with somebody else besides the Judgment Day. I think that there's, and also Rhea Ripley is so over on her own that I think that they're starting to kind of plant the seeds for the Judgment Day potentially breaking up. So removing the tag titles would be a good first step to doing that. I think that Awesome Truth would get one set because that sets up your feel-good WrestleMania moment. R-Truth makes everybody laugh. You know, he's never really had a moment like that at WrestleMania. It would be, it's like a Zack Ryder thing where you could potentially just take the titles off of them like the next night on Raw. And then I think the other set you could do A-Town Down Under. Those guys can get some heat.
Yeah, I really like the way you set that up there. I do like the whole fact that it's not just, hey, one set of titles and you're good. No, like, hey, split it up, and then all of a sudden it's like, hey, one team's got one team's got the other. It's like, oh, hey, you got new champs right there.
Yep.
A match that I said has been built for a long time, and a match I hope these two men just go out there, give them the right amount of time, please, because I feel like if this was a Vince-booked match, this would not get enough time. But Jey Uso versus Jimmy Uso. Would I love Yeet to win? Absolutely. But I'm sorry. I think you got to give this one to Jimmy, especially if the Bloodline's not going to be victorious a lot on this weekend. I think this is the match where I could see Jay getting his moment because, you know, he's the face. He's incredibly over right now. But this is the kind of match where I'm going to say this right now. I give the upper hand to Jimmy Uso, honestly.
I mean, I actually feel differently. I think that Jey Uso's got to win this match because, honestly, you know, they've had some long-term build that's been put into this, but the anticipation hasn't really quite reached a fever pitch level. Like, Jimmy has, like, screwed over Jay repeatedly, and that's fine, but I just feel like Jey Uso's character is over way more than Jimmy Uso. Like, Jimmy Uso, his heat in this match is dependent on the fact that people like Jey Uso a lot.
Yeah.
Rather than having any particular reason to dislike Jimmy. Like, he is there. He's a piece of all of this. But I feel like Jey Uso stands on his own as more of a star. And I think that given what's likely to happen later on night one, this is a trade-off. And I also think it kind of validates the Jey Uso singles push over the last couple of years where, hey, this guy may never actually become a heavyweight champion in WWE, but he can have a moment getting a win over his brother at WrestleMania. And I do think that these guys are going to work very hard to steal the show. Ultimately, I think that Gunther, Sami Zayn is going to be the better singles match on this show, but I do think that this can surprise some people.
The next two matches I'm going to run through very quickly because not that I don't care about them enough, I just think that they're on there to get people on the card, and that's a six-man tag with Bianca, Jay, Naomi taking on Damage Control, which this is a match set up to put the faces over. This is the
match.
Make Jay look strong, and then what I would love to see, though, is, hey, and then have Damage Control attack Bayley, like, say, because it's kind of giving away what we think is going to happen on night two. But then you can set up a potential Jade heel turn to where Jade's the one to face Bayley, maybe at like SummerSlam or something like that. Because I hate all the people that are like, oh, they're wasting Jade. I'm like, no. They're waiting for the right time to book her. That's the thing. People have to understand. Yeah. Just because someone's not getting used doesn't mean that they're not getting used properly. It's all about what they think's best long-term in their opinion. And then Latino World Order taking on Santos Escobar and Dirty Dominic Mysterio. Same thing. Just give LOW the match. These two matches just scream like a house show matches to me, you know?
Yeah, that could be sneaky, though, because I feel like, you know, that LWO, Santos, and Dom match, they're probably not going to get a ton of time, and I think that they're going to pack in a lot of fast-paced action. Dragon Lee being his first WrestleMania. We know that Rey and Dom worked really great together last year. Yeah, I mean, I think that this is going to, you know, as Kalisto would say, they're going to make a good lucha thing.
This could be like an 8 to 10 minute match where there's just some crazy shit that goes on and then someone gets the pin because the Bloodline versus Cody and Seth, you know, is probably going to get at least 25 minutes if I had to guess the way it's going to close night one.
Yep.
Sorry. This is Bloodline winning. This is Bloodline winning. This is going to basically be, you know, give Rock his moment, make Roman look really strong going into Sunday. Hell, I would go as far to say Cody's the one to eat the pin here because if Cody eats the pin on night one, it's going to plant those seeds of doubt where it's like, oh, Cody got his ass kicked last night. Can Cody do it on night two? The Bloodline looks really strong. You know, where like I said, I would love to see, like with Jimmy and Jay, though, I want to see Jay win. But something's telling me Jimmy. But with this match right here, this is about making your heels look strong. This is about making them look strong, dominant, and the ass kickers that they've been portraying to be. Have night one end with the final boss and the tribal chief going over.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of building up a climactic main event is so that the babyface can overcome all of the adversity. So naturally, we wouldn't want to take adversity away. It's got to be bloodline rules on night two to set up whatever they have planned.
Exactly. Which bleeds us into night two, which I'm just going off what Wikipedia says for the matches. Seth freaking Rollins taking on Drew McIntyre.
Yep.
I'm going to say this right now. There's a part of me that's in a 50-50 split because of the Money in the Bank implications, even though I doubt they do a cash-in. I could see like a Monday Night Raw cash-in on Monday night if they wanted to. But if they did that, I'll say this. For as good as Drew's been these last couple months, I can't see Seth losing this match. That's just my thing. I can't see Seth losing. He's been – I'll say this too. I know a lot of people say, oh, he wears goofy outfits. He does the dances. This is the best Seth Rollins has been in his career. I'm sorry, from his mic skills to his wrestling to just his overall TV persona, because he's embraced the character.
Yep, no, I would agree with that. I think that Seth is in total Shawn Michaels mode right now. You know, I mean, he's a guy who, like, he didn't have, I think, the natural, like, character aspect of wrestling. Like, he was, it's not like on the indies he was known as this, like, outlandish, you know, gimmicky kind of guy. He was, like, a no-nonsense, like, freaking nature athlete. But this is just proof that, like, you work at something, more reps, more experience, and now I think he's more polished than ever before. He's still capable of doing the athletic stuff and having these amazing matches, but he's got – you can tell all this time that he spent in the WWE system, his mic work, his presentation, he feels like a star. I think that, he's in that Shawn Michaels role where he may not be the face of the company, but he's definitely in that, like, you know, top five. And I think that, like, his star power is shining brighter than ever. Drew McIntyre's work has been amazing. I think that he's a very 21st century, a very 2024 version of a heel in wrestling, where it's not stereotypical stock villain tropes. It's real. It's like, all right, if you were a real person in this situation and you kind of took the glass half empty approach to all the things that were going on in your life, how would you react to these things? And I think that that's what's made his run so relatable. And I think that they actually are going to lean toward Drew winning the belt here. The only way that doesn't happen is if they have some kind of Money in the Bank. If the idea is Money in the Bank, I agree with you that it would be the next night on Raw. And that is a possible direction. But I could also see Drew McIntyre getting his moment after he didn't get it in front of fans because he won the title in the warehouse when COVID first struck. I could see them doing that here. Because I think that Seth, his title, he's had the title for a while now. And, I think that there's rumors he's going to need time off for surgery. So I could see Drew going over. My prediction is going to be Drew, but with the caveat that I like your Money in the Bank idea.
You know, give that night after Mania moment, because if it's like Drew wins and then like he gets attacked and then like, because you're right, Seth can kind of go away, but then Damian Priest just comes out of nowhere and then boom, Damian Priest gets his moment. Because even if Damian Priest cashes in, because I know we're saying it needs to add credibility to like, the Women's Royal Rumble, but the men's Money in the Bank, the cash-ins the last 2 years, like Austin Theory's was a dud. Otis was just Big E. Like, he had the title, but he only had the title for like 3.5 months, which him winning was great, but then they really fumbled the bag with the booking of him.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need to have Damian Priest have the credible booking, because guess what's coming up in 3 months? The next Money in the Bank event. So we'll have to wait and see what happens there. But there's already a couple people I have in mind. I don't know who's going to win the men's, but there's two people, or two women that I really like, and one that I like just because of where the event is, but one I like because of the purpose of Money in the Bank.
Sure.
I'm just going to blurt it out. Tiffany Stratton's the one that I have. I've given early Money in the Bank prediction to, which is what's happening in this next match, because Io Sky, who won the briefcase, cashed in the title, which I got to see live. So I got the, that's one thing off my wrestling bucket list. I got the cash check off was see a cash in live.
Yep.
Goes up against the Women's Royal Rumble winner in Bayley. Like we said earlier, I think Bayley wins. I know Bayley's the face, and everyone's like saying she's going to bring back the hugger persona. I don't see that. It's just been too long since it's been gone. You know, it's been gone for almost 5 years now.
Yeah.
I think that's past her. I think Bayley can be a face without doing the whole gimmicky, like, side ponytail and being this, like, cheerful underdog. She can be come in and, you know, just be that dominant woman's wrestler that everyone wants. Not, I'm not trying to, like, say anything bad against her, but you know what I mean? Like, where it's just, like, yeah, that's a woman in that ring, you know? Because, like, the Bayley, yep, other personas, like, it was childish. But it's kind of like Alexa Bliss's evolution as a character, where you had the fairy princess in NXT to the just crazy, batshit crazy girl who was, like, reigning terror over WrestleMania, like throughout 33, 34, the voodoo doll shirt that I have in my room that I got in New Orleans, which I might wear soon. But that's neither here nor there. But that's just my point on this match. Also, I'm going to say this right now. This is a sneaky good match that could be a match of the night contender. Do I think it will be? No, considering what the main event is. But I think these two women, given the right time, can go in there and they can do a really good match.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this match is going to surprise people. I think it's going to wind up being better than Rhea versus Becky on night one. I think that Becky's ring work, honestly, has never really done much for me. I think that she's always had it in terms of like her ring presence and, you know, the mic work and the character getting people fired up. But in terms of like, you know, wrestling skill, I feel like there's always been a lot of better women on the roster. Whereas with these girls, I mean, Io Sky is, she's been one of the best women's wrestlers in the world for the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. And I think that Bayley hasn't had as many opportunities to go out there and have an absolute banger. And I think that they could totally surprise some people and low key tear the house down here. So I think that Bayley's going to win for the reasons that we outlined above. But it's, I mean, hey, Io Sky, I mean, the fact that she's been the champion for this long, like credit to WWE for, you know, going like almost for committing months. For committing to the push with her. So I agree. I think that Bayley goes over and then you can focus. It may not be a very long title reign because you've got Jade Cargill waiting in the ring, in the wings. But hey, what a setup you have for the next couple months of SmackDown, right? So they're in a great spot.
They are. One thing I'll say quickly, too, is if I had to guess up, I'll say this with Rhea and Becky going back to the match quickly. I think there's a chance it opens Saturday night. I do think there's a chance because when I look at the rest of the matches Saturday, like obviously we know what's main eventing, but when I look at all the other matches, there's nothing here that really screams opener unless they wanted to go with, I think it's either Rhea and Becky or Jimmy and Jay. I think one of the two of them opens Saturday night.
For Saturday night opening match, I think that they. I could see the ladder match opening, or the Ray and Dom match. That's going to be my prediction.
I was going to say Ray and Dom, I think, would be the co, because like, you know, or the, you put the six women on there, you know, you kind of have that cool down, like you could do, if you want to do this, you could do Rhea and Becky goes on. So there's seven matches Saturday. You have Rhea and Becky go on fifth, and then you could have the, like LWO tag team match go on sixth, and then seventh you have the tag team match, the main event. You know, you kind of have that combo for the storm matches. You don't want to have two matches back to back because we've learned what happens with WrestleMania 25. Shawn and Taker go on fifth. The two matches that followed them, like people were kind of.
I don't think that you have that issue though, because I mean, the main event here is so anticipated that I think that you can go for a bottom top structure. And you have no doubt in your mind that the main event is going to get the biggest reaction, no matter what match you put before it.
Yeah. No, I was just spitballing there. A match I can see opening Sunday, though, is LA Knight versus AJ Styles in a singles match. Yeah, I'm gonna say this. I'm giving it to LA Knight. Give them his mania moment. The crowd's gonna be behind them. They're gonna be super over. Yeah. So yep. That's all I gotta say with that one.
I agree completely. I wish that. To me, this is the one criticism that I have of the booking for the matches this year. I think that the right match to do would have been LA Knight versus Logan Paul for the US title. To me, if you didn't want to give LA Knight the Universal title, totally understand that. But there's no reason that he couldn't have won the US title to kind of validate how over he is with the crowd. But that being said, if you're not going to put him in a title match, I mean, you can't ask for much more than putting him against a workhorse like AJ Styles. If anybody's going to give this guy a good match, it's AJ Styles. And yeah, I totally expect LA to go over.
Logan Paul, Randy Orton, and Kevin Owens in a triple threat for the United States title. Call me crazy. I think this is a match Randy Orton gets. I know it sounds weird, but it's just, you know, they always throw a curveball. Now, there's obviously the Vince curveball, which a Vince curveball is more of a, like, why did you do that? This is a curveball in the sense of, give Randy Orton, you know, that like one last title run, like maybe have it bleed off into a program where Logan Paul can kind of go away for a little bit, have Randy versus Kevin where like Randy wins, but he like pins Kevin Owens so that, you know, Logan Paul technically doesn't lose the championship, which can cause a bit of a feud there. It's just a little something, a fun little curveball, because with all these matches, the way they're booked, you have to have a few surprises here or there, or things you didn't see coming.
Yeah, I mean, the one knock on that, I guess, would be like, this match, the issue is more between Logan and KO dating back several months. So if you are going to do a title change, the payoff would be Owens winning the belt. But I think that you're in a situation here where you can really go in any direction. If you want Logan to keep the belt, that's fine. Randy and Owens, either one of them are credible for winning the match, but both of them are above this title. So to me, this just comes across like a match, you know, to have a match. But it'll be a good one. The winner I could see going really any of the three. I guess if I had to lean one, I might lean Owens just because of the story and the build. But I could totally see Logan just retaining here.
So I just do Randy Orton just because, like I say, you need a few curveballs in there. Because like WrestleMania 34, I actually rewatched that a few days ago. But the opener was Finn Balor, Miz, and Seth Rollins. Everyone thought Finn Balor was the one that was going to go over. Seth Rollins ended up winning the match, so that's where I kind of get the logic for this one here, where it's like, hey, expect the unexpected person to win. The Pride versus the Final Testament, like I said, this is just another match to get people on there. I don't really think much into this. I'm just going to say Final Testament just because we haven't really said that many heels winning so far on this card. Most of the people we've said, like, if you look at it, like Seth and Drew, that's like the only one, but then like Bayley winning, LA winning, Randy Orton or Kevin Owens wins. This is just going to get the heel over because I feel like you can't have a card where you have dominated by faces, dominated by heels. So this kind of just, like, you know, adds that little mix into there.
I agree completely. I think just to balance it out, Final Testament goes over.
Exactly. And then the match everyone's waiting for. Let's see, stipulation to be determined. I didn't realize that this match was a TV determined match. Honestly, I think it'll end up being like Noel's Bar, no DQ, or
it's Bloodline rules. If the Bloodline wins on night one.
Yeah, or Bloodline rules. It just says TBD here. That's all. I didn't realize it was Bloodline rules.
Yeah, that's why it says that.
Okay. So, because I can't see, like, I was thinking about it. Like, I almost said I quit, but I was just like, I can't see an I quit match happening here. Like, Roman losing his title by saying, I quit. But, you know what? At the end of the day, I'm a smart man. I love wrestling. Story's getting finished Sunday night. You know what? This match, it's going to make, because this is the one where it's going to be booked as, it's against all odds. Cody doesn't have a chance. That's why Saturday night you have the heels look strong to end the show. Sunday, you get that storybook ending that every wrestling fan is going to want. That woe in Lincoln Financial Field is going to be amazing. But here's the other thing, too. The American Nightmare winning the title in the birthplace of America. You cannot script this shit, people.
No. And in such a historic wrestling city,
that too.
Yeah. I think that it's just a great great moment for Cody. You know, it's the validation of an 8-year journey, and it's the right time to do it. And it's gonna be an amazing moment. I think it says so much about everybody involved in this storyline that they've been able to keep up the enthusiasm for this after last year. People wanted it really, really bad. I thought last year they couldn't possibly have a bigger moment than Cody winning in Los Angeles. And as it turns out, by bringing The Rock in and doing this whole Final Boss storyline And, you know, this two-night saga. Finally, we've seen a WrestleMania with the two-night format taking advantage of this to do two-night storytelling, a match that directly affects the second night. And I think that they just have the table is set for something really special here. You know, there's no reason not to put unreachable expectations, but you know, Cody Roman, it's going to be special regardless, but to me, this has like all-time classic potential. I think that's to me is this match's ceiling, is like historic all-time WrestleMania classic. And I'm going to throw out a wild card prediction that there will be a moment in here where there's a beatdown happening, and all of a sudden, you got Final Boss heel Rock, and who better to offset Glass Shatters one more time, Stone Cold versus The Rock at WrestleMania. A little moment there. The match is going to be anything goes, so they can kind of have it for a second, and then that gets Rock out of the picture, and it allows Cody to finish the story.
I thought you were going to say MJF for a second, which we don't know what's happening there, but I feel like if MJF had a debut, it would be a Raw.
He's playing games.
Yeah.
He might wind up there someday, but right now I think he's just messing with people. I think that Stone Cold actually – I'm going to give it a solid 40% chance of happening. I think
it's like Mick Foley in 99, you know?
What's that?
Mick Foley in 99 in Worcester, Mass.
There you go. Absolutely.
Yeah, like my thing with this too is just it's not only the story finishing, but it's just it's the ending people want. It's WrestleMania 40. You're gonna want to give, because think about it. Do you really want your crowd? I'm not even gonna say pissed off. They're gonna. It's just gonna be, you know, when we were younger and you did something really stupid, and your parents were just like, "I'm disappointed in you." That's what wrestling fans are gonna feel if this doesn't happen. That's like. Like, if they don't get the finish that they want, it's just – it's going to anger the fan base. And you don't want to anger the fan base at this point. So what are you going to do? Give them the ending that they want. Do last year to where now it's just like, hey, we know what – they've been building towards this moment. You can finally cash in on this moment. You can finish the story. Like you said, the table is set and it's ready for Cody to sit at the head of the table. Because you know what you can have him do? You can have him go main event France in a month. You can have him go main event Glasgow, which just got announced, I think, this morning.
Correct.
You can main event Toronto and Money in the Bank coming up, which, fun fact for those of you who don't know out there, I'm getting married on the same day as Money in the Bank in Toronto, so I will not be there. I have a little bit of prior priorities. Here's the other one, too. SummerSlam in Cleveland. If you really wanted to, you could have a match. You could have the rematch. You don't need to do Seth, you don't need to do Roman versus Cody immediately after. You can have it build. But then you can also have the Final Boss turning on the Tribal Chief to win next. That can build towards WrestleMania 41, which, like I said earlier, Minnesota is the front runner. But if you had to pick a city for WrestleMania, if they said, Jared, where do you want to go for WrestleMania? Like, what's a city you would love to see them go to?
I mean, really, if it's Roman versus The Rock, I feel like it would my ideal city for that would have to be Miami.
You know what? I like it. I really like it. But I have another city in mind where I...
A fresher one, right?
It's not fresher. They've been to Miami before, but obviously, like, I know... So the Super Bowl was in Miami in 2010, and then they went back in 2020 after renovation. So I feel like those are going to clear there, and the stadium's going to look a lot better than it did for 28. But, man... Las Vegas is right there.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's the no-brainer, right? Yeah, I mean, I thought that would have come before Minneapolis. I mean, that just doesn't scream WrestleMania City to me. You know what I mean?
it screams it's a WrestleMania City in the sense of, like, you know, hey, the Super Bowl went there. Like, you know how the Super Bowl did MetLife just to say, hey, we went there once? I think Minneapolis is, like, the same sort of thing, like, where they probably won't get it again. They're just going to... get it, like, say, hey, we're going to show off our city. Because when I look at WrestleMania cities for the future, I do think Tampa gets one. I think Tampa's going to get a proper WrestleMania, you know, full stadium, all the events and stuff like that. I think they do go back to Phoenix someday. Where's another one they're going to go back to? I feel like Miami, Orlando are like the easy ones to pick. I know Nashville is getting a new stadium soon. I feel like they're probably going to want to go there. One that I'm surprised they haven't done is Atlanta, just considering Atlanta's a big city. It's a big wrestling city, but they also have
They did Atlanta about 10 years ago. So, they did go there. That was 27.
Yes, and then everyone's favorite, New Orleans. So they have options, but like I said, I think they do Minneapolis next year. I feel like we'll get an announcement this weekend, but because if they were going to do Vegas, they would have announced it at that kickoff event, when they were in Las Vegas. I know they were there for Super Bowl, but hey, what a perfect opportunity to announce to the world, hey, we're coming to your city next year. So I think 41 Minneapolis, 42 Vegas, and then 43... we'll say Miami, but I think honestly to see Rock and Roman in Miami would be really, really cool.
Yeah. No, I mean, I definitely am with you that I think WrestleMania in Vegas just has to happen. It makes all the sense in the world. It would be nice if that was the first time WWE was in that stadium, because they did do SummerSlam in that stadium a few years ago. No one's going to care about that though. It's more like, hey, WrestleMania is in Vegas. That's a big deal. And it's TKO, the merger with UFC. Of course it's going to be in Vegas within the next few years.
They moved NXT, moved one of their shows from Savannah, Georgia to the UFC Apex, which only holds like 200 people. So I just put Vegas in there, but I'll say this too. If a Vegas Mania happens, do not go for a full week. No man in this world needs to be in Las Vegas for a week. Like that's one of the cities too. If it's in Vegas, I'm there. I would say you go Friday, you go Saturday, you go Sunday, and then Monday or Tuesday, you fly home. I'd probably do Tuesday just so I can get the Raw, but that's just me. The only thing with that though is I don't know if I would do Takeover or Stand and Deliver, but because it's 9 in the morning start, where I'm just like, do I really want to go watch professional wrestling at 9 o'clock in the morning? I don't know, especially in a Vegas bender hangover when I'm 30. Not really. Mm-hmm. So that's all she wrote, folks, from Jared Silverclay, myself. You know what, guys? No matter if you're here for football, no matter if you're here for wrestling, enjoy the show this weekend if you're watching. If you want to watch it, WWE Network in Canada, Peacock in the United States, or wherever you get your local cable provider's pay-per-view access, if you're still doing that 10 years later. But anyway, guys, episode 289 is in the books. We'll be back very soon. But like I said before, and I'll say it again, enjoy WrestleMania. Have a good night.
Do, Did, Will, the Story of People podcast is now available on the Crier Media Network. The first 5 episodes are here and feature some incredible guests that fit into one or all 3 of those categories. Ready? Tara Sloan from the San Jose Sharks, Undercurrent Podcast, NBC Sports. Marianne Iveson from Iveson Voice and the Let's Take This Outside podcast to talk about the world of outdoors as well as voiceover land. Ariana Hunsicker, future Canadian Paralympic swimmer, already winning tons of awards for this country. Scott McGregor from the Hot Wallet podcast to dumb down the world of crypto, Bitcoin, and NFTs so you don't have to. And Jackie Holowaty from Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle, Washington, the first net zero carbon certified arena on the planet. Wherever you get your pods, wherever you watch your pods, and on the Crier Media Network.
Hi, I'm Logan Anderson, host of the Say the Damn Score podcast. On my show, I deep dive into the sports broadcasting business by, you guessed it, talking to sportscasters. The show has featured big names like Bob Costas, Kenny Albert, and Vern Lundquist, as well as many up-and-coming broadcasters who you may not know yet, but you will know soon. Whether you're looking for professional development as a sportscaster, different career paths, or if you just want to be entertained by hearing some of the best storytellers in the world tell their own stories, this podcast is for you. You can subscribe to the podcast on all major podcast platforms, or you can visit our website, saythedamnscore.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.